Welcome to Jewish History with Rabbi David Katz, connecting the human side to Jewish history. For sponsorship opportunities or to support this podcast, please visit our donate page at www.support.rabbidavidkatz.com.
Hi, I'm going to, as always, snatch some time when I see the window to try to do the biography podcast for one for the week. And right now, I dropped my daughter off here and I dropped whatever. I have a few minutes. So I heard this week is Rabbeinu Yonah. That's what I can do. The famous Rabbeinu Yonah Gerona, who, as he probably knows, is Shari Teshuva. And here we have they're always very interesting, but this one is very strange, perhaps, in some respects. Not for reasons you imagine. Rabbeinu Yonah was a big rabbi in Spain, a Sephardi, in the 1200s. He didn't live a long life. He was in his early 50s when he died, early 50s. And he was the first cousin with the Ramban. I think the parents were brother and sister. If I remember correctly, the Ramban's mother is a sister of Rabbeinu Yonah's father, something like that. Which means they came from the aristocratic rank of the Sephardic Jews. But I can't use the word Sephardi over here because if you're talking the 1200s, remember, as I've said over and over again, I know some know it and some won't know it even when I say it. There was no Spain, but there were different kingdoms. And the Rabbeinu Yonah lived in Aragon, in Catalonia. And this is something I've spoken about on a number of previous occasions. Maybe some of you will recognize it. But he lived in a very interesting period for the following reason. Once upon a time, there was no Jews in Spain. And then there were Jews in Spain, mostly when the Muslims conquered it. And when the Muslims took it over, so Jews moved there from all over the place. And then you have what he called the golden age of the Jews in Islamic Spain, with those Rishonim and poets and, you know, grammar people and artists and so on and so forth. Fine. But then that shut down because in 1150, the Muslims, a different group of Muslims took over in Spain and they closed down Judaism. That's when the Rambam, Maimonides, was a young boy. So after that, from 1150 to 1492, there's no such thing as the Jews in Muslim Spain. Instead, the Jews in Islamic Spain either had to convert or flee or they died. Where did they flee to? So many went north to the upper part of Spain, which by that time was part of the Christians. See, the Muslims conquered most of Spain in the 700s, but then the part they left over was like a tumor. If you don't get rid of it totally, it'll come back. And little by little, the Christians, slowly and steadily, over 800 years, little by little, reconquered all of Spain from the Muslims. So if you're talking at the period I'm in, after 1150, so Spain was more or less 50-50. The upper half was already ruled by the Christians, and the southern half was ruled by the Muslims. If you give it another 50-60 years, then two-thirds and three-quarters even is ruled by the Christians. That's the world in which Rabbeinu Yonah Gerona, because he was born in the 1210, actually, and he only lived to be 1265, 1264, something like that. So, you know, first half of the 1200s, as we say. And he's from Barcelona. So that's the area that you and I know as the north eastern part of Spain. I spoke about it a number of times. Many famous rabbis came there, from there. That's what they call today Catalonia, which is a very distinct part of Spain. The language is not your regular Spanish, and they don't like being part of Spain, and what used to be called the Kingdom of Aragon. Now, listen closely. The Muslim era, the Jews in Islamic Spain closed down in 1150 when the Muslims turned around and prohibited Judaism. Until then, there had been a certain style of learning among Spanish Jews, what I would call the Arabic style of learning. This is what we call the Rif, the Rimigash, the Rambam, people like that. It's a certain style. I don't want to go into it exactly now, but it wasn't exactly the way Rashi and Tosfos said it. They had a certain way. And it evolved on its own from the Arabic world. I might remind you, the Goanim lived in the Arabic world. Once put the Gemara together and, you know, edited it and so forth. Now, at the same time, there was something called Ashkenaz. These were the Jews in northern France and in western Germany. People like Rashi and the Bali Tosfos. So they're all living at the same time, but they're in very different cultural contexts. So I'm speaking now very specifically about Gemara learning, not the other stuff. So the people like the Rambam, as they say before, and Rimagash and people like that, they had one Mahalach in learning, and their yeshiva was organized along those lines. Whereas at the same time, in, you know, a couple hundred miles to the north, in northern France and in western Germany, we call Ashkenaz, a different style of learning had evolved, mainly what you and I associate with Tosfos. Now, the Jews in Spain had one way, and the Jews in France and Germany had a different way, and they usually didn't mish. However, the whole yeshiva world was destroyed in 1150 in southern Spain, in Muslim Spain. I might recall the Rambam had to pretend to be an Arab and then flee the country eventually because he couldn't even pretend until he had ran away to Egypt. So it became possible to live as a Jew and certainly to learn Torah in Islamic Spain. So that became only possible in the upper half of the country, in the Christian parts, which are mainly the two big kingdoms of Castile and Aragon. Castile being the central part of the Christian Spain, and Aragon being on the eastern side, against the Mediterranean. So something interesting happens. Since the old yeshiva system collapsed because of this political change, this religious persecution change, so what did people in the upper half do in Spain? Did they just try to pick up the ball and say, well, this is how they used to learn before we were all expelled from Spain, so let's try to keep it up? They could have. After all, the northern half of Spain is close to the southern half of Spain. Moreover, as the 1100s went by and the 1200s, the Christians actually end up taking over, you know, three quarters and eventually, you know, literally 95% of Spain by the middle 1200s. So it wasn't, out of mind, it wasn't out of possible that they would start picking up the Spanish way of learning that they learned in the Rambam's time and the Rif's time and all the rest of it. But that, my friends, is not what happened. Instead, something very interesting happened. Rabbeinu Yonah is a very important part of it, that after the collapse of Islamic Spain, some smart boys from the northern half of the Christian part of Spain, in other words, they said, you know, we can't go any more south to Lucena and the Lakewoods and the Volusians and the Punaviches that used to be 50, 60, 80 miles from our house in the southern part of Spain because it doesn't exist anymore. So instead of sending one up among our own, let's go to the other set of Volusians and Punaviches and, Lakewoods and whatever you want to call it, in the north. But there aren't any in Spain. That's right. They went to Ashkenaz. And so you started to see, first one was the Yad Ramah, Meir Balafia, in 1100s. But by the time you get to the early 1200s, boys from good families, aristocratic families who have a tradition of learning along with the money, started saying, I'm going to go to another country north called France, which was very, very different cultural climate, and I'm going to go to the yeshivas there. And I'll pick up their style of learning, because I hear it's very advanced. It's not exactly the way we used to do it in southern Spain, but it is certainly a hush of a system. And that's what they did. And one of the first people is Yonah of Gerona, Rabbeinu Yonah, who as a young man, so if he's born in 1210, so imagine somebody going, let's give him, 15 years old, say, in 1225 approximately, something like that. He heads north, and he went to Normandy, which is part of Spain, France. It was actually a separate duchy in France, to Evreux. Now, most of you have no idea what I'm talking about. Evreux is a town in Normandy in France. You look it up. In Evreux was one of these examples of these small but very vibrant Tosafistic yeshivas. The Tosas you and I use today are really the Tosas of Evreux. You don't know it, because it's gone through many, what's the right word, Gilgals. But because one of them was a Blazer Touche, and that became the Tosis Touche, whatever. But that's a whole schmooze by itself. I don't have time to do that on a podcast. Once in a while, when I go on the road, I do that one. But you have to have more learned and sophisticated audience to appreciate that. You know, the Tosis that we have today, where's it all come from? And these would be students of the Rajba, not the Rajba, but the Rajba, Rishim Shem Ben Avram of Sons, who's the guy that actually wrote the Tosis down in the form that we have it today. But in a more precise way, his students included these people that you've never heard of, you see in Tosis every once in a while, and you see what they call Ibra, you know, Alf Yud Yud Beis Reish Aleph or something like that. So Pirush Ibra or Tosis Ibra or Moshe Mishnir Me Ibra, and then, I don't know where it is. It's Evero, you know. It's a well-known town, not large, in Normandy, and all the way, you know, all the way in northern France. Super Catholic, super, you know, not Spanish. So what? And he went up there, and he learned there for a number of years, learned up a storm, and he became Ashkenized, meaning his soul. There's no question in my mind that, yeah, he wasn't speaking Spanish anymore. He's speaking French or Yiddish or something like that, whatever they spoke over there. And he's picking up the, what shall I say, the style of learning for sure from these famous Bali Tosas that you never heard of, Ramosha of Evero, Shmuel of Evero, you know. Believe me, they're big players. And I'll say it again, they're Talmidim of the Rajba, not the Rajba, but the Rajba, so, you know, the Rashbishan. So they're big people. And, of course, he knows the Ashkenazi way of davening and Minhagim and all the rest, even though he's not Ashkenaz. He remained what he was, a Catalonian Jew. Spanish in the Barcelona-Girona sense, which is a certain province in Spain. That's who he was all his life. But nevertheless, he ain't your typical Sephardi guy that, you know, Sephardi born, Sephardi bred, and when you die, Sephardi dead. It's a, you know, he went through a period in which he learned in a very, very different environment. It's a little bit like these Moroccan and other kids that, you know, went... When I was young and young before my time, you went to Mir, to Lakewood and all the rest, used to see this. So even though they're coming from, you know, Tunisia, Morocco, all the rest, they become Litvishized to some degree, you know what I mean? So even though they may inspire them, of course. So that's what happened with him. So he's the first one. After him came a whole bunch of kids. And it's part of a trend. And I can't exactly say he's the first. His cousin did the same thing, the Ramban, except in the case of the Ramban, who also lived in Girona. So they knew each other, they were close friends and so forth, even though the Ramban is 10 years older and lived 10 years longer. The Ramban lives like something from 1194 to, I don't know, 1270 or whatever. Ben Yonah lived, born 10 years later and lived and died 10 years earlier. But having said that, the Ramban also is a Spanish boy who, in his case, if I remember correctly, he didn't go to Lakewood. Lakewood came to him. Reb Nissen Turkuntai, who was Reb Nissen of the small, stupid little French town called Turkuntai. Came and got a job as a Rebbe in Spain, and therefore he was Mashpia in that way on the Ramban. So here you have a definite trend, which is, especially in Aragon, Spanish boys are learning in Litvish yeshivas, or in that case, those cases, Tosafistic yeshivas, and they brought into Spain the Tosafistic style of learning, which means all the, dialectics, you know, Im Tomar this, Yishlomar that. What do you have to steer between two Gemaras, or you know, what it says in this place in Shas, in that place in Shas, or you know, Minei Bay, the typical things that we see in Tosas, they brought into Spain, and that became the style, the dialectical style, that was characteristic of Ashkenaz, but had not been characteristic of Sephard, now entered Ashkenaz, and that's why in the 1200s, when these boys came home, and started their own schools and yeshivas, all the rest of it, they revolutionized the whole concept business. And all the famous rabbis that you've heard of in the yeshiva are come from Aragon, from Catalonia, in the 1200s. It's Rabbeinu Yonah, it's the Ramban, it's the Rajba, it's the Ritva, and later the Ran, and so forth. You understand? And people like that. So these are the meat and potatoes of the yeshivas. And they're Ashkenazi boys from Christian Spain, the northern half of Spain, who went and, as I say, converted mentally to the Ashkenaz way of learning, and then brought it back to Spain. And as you know, you look at these Chidushim of these Rishonim, it's the same Kashas and Tosas, sometimes the same Teres, of course, sometimes not the same Teres. And then that's your job as a Makachir to say, how come Tosas get this, you know, Teres, this Yesh Lomar, and the Rajba, or the Ramban, or the Ritva, or one of those people, you know, or Ben Yonah for that matter, it gives a different terrace. And then you're off to the races. So, Ben Yonah is therefore a very important historical figure in this regard. But it doesn't end there. While he was there, he got, shall I say, brainwashed Ashkenaz style in the sense that very anti-philosophical, very right-wing, very anti-Maimonidean. And the Rambam died in 1204. So the Rambam died about 5 years before he was born. The Mor Nevuchim was translated around that time, about 1205. The Mor Nevuchim had been written by the Rambam in around 1190 or so, which was, you know, let's say 20 years before Ben Yonah was born. But it didn't get out there. It was in Arabic. It wasn't translated in Hebrew for everybody to read until the early 1200s. And then when it hit, it had an explosion, the Mor Nevuchim, the Guide for the Perplexed. Because it has all these ideas, which could be strange to a super yeshivish, literalistically minded Ashkenazi yeshiva student, which is what most people are today. Because the Rambam undertakes to give a philosophical and metaphorical interpretation of a lot of things that people don't feel comfortable regarding it as metaphorical and philosophical, even though they don't necessarily take it literally either. You understand? So that's a whole discussion by itself, but nevertheless, that was the discussion at that time. So all I can tell you is that the publication of the Mor Nevuchim in the early 1200s and its reaching of Spain and then France led to a polarization. Half the people loved it. They said, this is the greatest thing since Swiss cheese. Now he's explaining the whole Torah and all the stories in the Torah that bother me in a very clear, logical, philosophical fashion. This is Gewaldig. These people became known as the Maimonideans. But there were also other people who said, this is crazy. Where did he get this from? They all knew the Rambam's a big Talmud Chacham. Nobody challenged that. They all said the Rambam's a great man. Nobody challenged that. But this stuff is nuts. And it's kafira. So it's weird. He's not a kofer. You hear what I'm saying? They didn't say the Rambam. They wouldn't say Rambam's a kofer. And they say he's a tzaddik. But nevertheless, great as he is, certain parts of what he wrote are kafira. That's what they held. And one of the main, this really developed, I would say, in France, southern France. And Ben Yonah ended up, after he learned in Normandy, maybe met the guy there, whatever, with Reb Shlomo Minahar, who was a Spanish Jew, also from Barcelona, but ended up having yeshiva in southern France. And that yeshiva became like a Satmar headquarters, extreme right wing. And they were the ones, like you see today, you know, they put a Pashkevil in and all this stuff. It's exactly what happened at that time. They're the ones who became convinced that the Rambam's philosophical writings are total kafira. Again, they had the difficult task of being Palgin and Dibura. Yes, the Rambam's a great man, and the Mishnah Torah is great, and he was a wonderful person, and so on and so forth. And Tzadik Yisod Olam, they said all that. However, so having said that, this part about Hilchos Deis is kafira, and this part of Mor Nevuchim, this part of Mor Nevuchim is kafira, and oh my goodness, anybody does is a kofer, and so on and so forth. Mind you, the Rambam had ticked them off by saying anybody imagines God could have a goof is going to burn in hell. They said, we can imagine that, not literally perhaps, but in some fashion. And, you know, so sharp words in the part of the Rambam led to very sharp reactive words. And we call this in history the Maimonidean controversies. And the guy who was smacking the belly button of this whole controversy was the young assistant to the Rosh Yeshiva in Montpellier. And the Rosh Yeshiva was Rav Shlomo Minahar, and the young assistant was Yonah, Rav Yonah Gerona. And they became like, you know, like I said, were headquarters for the Pashkevilim. They put out letters, and the Rosh Yeshiva said to Rabbeinu Yonah, you used to learn up north in Normandy. You know all the Ashkenazi Rosh Yeshivas. They'll be shocked if you show them this stuff. So go up there and show them this stuff and get a cherem. And he got one. He went up there. They didn't know much about the Rambam. Let's put it this way. They knew about the Rambam as a great Talmud Chacham, but they didn't know about philosophy stuff, and they didn't understand a bit of it because it wasn't part of the whole Yeshiva Mahalacha of Machshava. And, you know, the Rambam was coming from an Aristotelian perspective and all that. And so they say, yeah, this is definitely kafira. Of course. Or they didn't use the words kafira. They didn't say those words, but they said, so put a cherem on it. And what they meant was, very much an attitude that you'll find in the form world today, which is, Of course you should learn the Mishnah Torah Yom V'Laila. Rav Chaim Brisker wrote on the Mishnah Berurah. We all know that. The Mishnah Melech and the, Kesem Mishnah, all that. Of course. But the Maravuchim Nisht. You see, the Maravuchim is not for you. Who knows what it means? And that's not something we generally dally in. And they use stronger language, but that's what it boiled down to. Well, all I can tell you is a gigantic reaction hit from the left wing. Now, the left wing was everybody else except the Pashkevillan guys, meaning these guys backed themselves in the corner. And the way the Maimonideans, pro guys, took it is you insulted the Rambam and called them names, which isn't exactly what happened, but nevertheless, it smelled of that. And the reaction was gigantic. And all over the place, starting in northern Spain, they started issuing cherems on the guys that put this out, especially they stigmatized, what's his name, the Rishlom Menahar, and the Rabbeinu Yonah Gaona, and another guy you never heard of. And so all of a sudden, these guys became infamous. You know, everybody's putting him in cherem. Once upon a time, a cherem was considered an important big deal. The Ramban was like in the middle of this, because he kind of sympathized with, the anti-Maimonideans on some points, but in the other, he realized very clearly that it seemed that it's very hard to do, as they say before, Palgina Dibura, to say the Rambam's great, but the ideas are not great. And he certainly liked his cousin, Rabbeinu Yonah Gaona, but all hell broke loose, I can tell you that. And people fought, and by the time it's over, nobody knows. There's a lot of legends about this. There are a lot of lies and legends about this whole episode, because that's what Jews do. And they're famous mices that you hear there and there, but they're just not true. But by the time it's over, somebody caused somewhere the burnings of the Rambam's books by the Catholic Church. Okay? Now, it's very possible the right wing did it, but we don't know that for sure. But everybody thought they did. Everybody thought Rabbeinu Shlomo Nahar went to the Catholic Church and he was malshin on them and this and that and the other. We don't know that from a history perspective, but, that's what they thought. And, oh my goodness, and mind you, the people that were opposed to Rabbi Shlomo Nahar and the others said the same thing. They said he's a big Talmud Chacham, he's a real from guy, no question about it. But on this particular item, he went off the derech, he's nuts, and he should be put in excommunication. Same thing with Yonah Gaona, his young assistant. So here's a guy who's about 25 years old, maybe 30 years old, something like that. This story happened in the early 1230s. So Rabbeinu Yonah was born in 1210. He's a guy 22, 23, 25 years old. Yeshiva Hakker, as we call it today. Who has got his, it probably was writing the Pashkevillah, his finger right in the middle of the whole controversy, you understand? And it got really bad. There are many stories that go, one will never know which is the truth, but they do say that the other side was so angry that they burned the books, that they were malshin on Shlomo Nahar, and they chopped his tongue out. I'm talking about the Catholic Church. By the time, because all you have to say in Middle Ages, this guy dissed Jesus, that's all that you have to say. They'll punish you, whether it's true or not. you're talking about the 1200s over here. I'm not going to give a history disquisition. The Roman Catholic Church was in an anti-Aristotle mood in the early 13th century. We call it the Albigensian crisis. But that's not for here or now. But they were very predisposed to hear Tynes against an Aristotelian presentation of cosmology and religion. Be that as it may, the whole thing ended up in a terrible mess. And there is a story that's widely believed. I don't believe it. It's in one book called Tagmuli HaNefesh from the Hill of Verona, where he says that as a result of all this, Rabbeinu Yonah decharata, and he publicly apologized. He went around from community to community all over Spain saying, I sinned against the Rambam, and heaven forgive me, and that's why he wrote the Shari Chu and all the rest. That's a bunch of baloney. But it's a good story. He was going to go to Eretz Yisrael and all the rest of it. Now, having said that, I don't know, I wasn't there, but the historical records don't seem to bear that at all. It's just one of the really good stories for a Pirkei or something, Rabbis like to use it in blogs or whatever. But it's a vivid story. What actually happened, as far as I can tell, and that's all you ever get with me, as far as I can tell, is that here's a guy who was, like I say, 25 years old, Rabbeinu Yonah Gaona. This stuff happened in the early 1230s, so he was in his 20s. Once all this blew away, he says, I'm out of here. And he returned back to Spain, to Barcelona, which was a thriving Jewish community. He got a job in a local yeshiva because everything I just told you is taking away from the fact that mainly he was a Gemara learner. You know, in other words, mainly he was a Shibisha type guy, and mostly what he learned in Ashkenaz was just, as we call today, Gemara Shitosis. In other words, the Tosafistic analysis of the Gemara itself. So Rabbeinu Yonah was an Iyun guy, you know, not a Bekiyas guy, Iyun guy. And he was, for the rest of his life, a Rosh Hashiva. Here's a story that happened when, let's say, he's 25, and he died at the age of 53. So put it together, you know, not even 30 years like that. The only thing is that his reputation was such that eventually he got an offer for a better yeshiva position or a rabbonis position, and that was in Toledo. And that's where he went, and that's where he spent the rest of his life. So he was in Barcelona, which is in Aragon on the Mediterranean Sea, and then he was in Toledo, which was the capital city of Castile, which these are two important, very important Jewish communities. Now, he's somebody who came from a wealthy family, from the Germans called Bildung und Besitz. You know, it was an aristocratic Jewish family in the sense of learning and money and all the rest of that. That is true, no question about it. And on the other hand, he was Rosh Reuben learning. So if you want to really know who Rabbeinu Yonah was, you got to do his Lamdishus form, which have not survived. So he's a big Maggid Shia. The only one I know of is the one in Boa Basa, Elias Rabbeinu Yonah, which I remember from the yeshiva days. I don't think I've looked at it in 20 years. But you remember Elias Rabbeinu on Boa Basra? You know, it's Elios because after he does the sugya, ha'olam he called Varenu. What's the bottom line? What's the sikum of the sugya? So, ola, ola, ola is Elios Rabbeinu Yonah. But I believe he wrote a whole shas, or something like that. That's what they say. And his students included all the big Rosh Yeshivas that came afterwards, you know, as far as that's concerned. And therefore, his main thing was the learning. We've all heard, you know, you look in the back of the Gemara, what do you call it? Talmidei Rabbeinu, what is it called? Talmidei Rabbeinu Yonah, you know, on the Rif and all that sort of thing. Like on Brachas, you know, places like that. So those are halacha and learning. They're not, you know, philosophy and all the rest of it. So I just want you to understand. So we're dealing with a person who primarily was in learning. I think part of the reason that he backed out of the world of Pashkevillim and politics is that when you bite, somebody bites you back. When you write a Pashkevillim, they can write one about you. And in his case, since the Maimonidean side thought that the anti-Maimonidean side is putting out outrageous pamphlets and Pashkevillim, as they say, so they started attacking him, and they said, I guess we all know your grandfather, your great-grandfather, was married to Pelegesh, meaning your grandparents were not married. Now, this this drove him crazy, and the Ramban got involved, and he said, it's not true, and we made a Chakira, it's not so. You see, he touched a button. So it must have been something back there in the woodwork. This touches on a fact that this is, I won't say it's unique to Spain, because unfortunately it wasn't, but in Spain, because you had the Muslims, and the Christians, and the Jews, and everybody submitted, and this conquest and that conquest, you had a big problem with the morality and the immorality in the Jewish communities in Spain. Of course, the Kal v'chomer the Goyish communities, I'm only interested in the Jewish communities. And all the way through all these centuries, you always had a big problem with, like, what they call pilagshim, which means, well, in English, a concubine, that doesn't mean anything. Pilagshim is a loaded term. It can mean a Jewish girl, it can mean a Geisha girl, it can mean a Shiksa. Okay, either one. Depends how and when it's used. And it's very complicated, but people would have a wife, but that's your formal wife. But then they also want to have somebody on the side. That could be Jewish. So why didn't you marry her? Well, she was your maid. And you're from a Chasha family, you're not going to marry a maid. But meanwhile, she had 2-3 children with her. So therefore, she's a Pelegesh. So the wife lives in one house, the maid lives in another. This is crazy. This they picked up from the Muslims, you understand, which is very common. And that was a halbitzara. Because in addition to that, you also had the following phenomenon, which is, many books have been written on this, by the way, unfortunate phenomenon. You also had the following phenomenon, that people just took live-in Geisha women. So you could be a Jewish guy, especially wealthy or something like that. He has a Jewish wife. In addition, he has 2 or 3 or 4 Pilakshim, that is, they're going Muslim women, Christian women. You know, in the Muslim countries, they would take Christian women because they were the captives. In the Christian countries, they were Muslim women, they were the captives. And it wrecked the whole Jewish life. If you know where to look, you'll see that this farmer actually complaining about this all the time. It was a problem in Spain. It was a Makas of Medina, and you couldn't get rid of it. You did not have this in Ashkenaz, to the best of my knowledge. You didn't have this in most countries, but you definitely had it in Spain. It's like it's weird, but that was there. And so when they called his that you're descended from a Pelegesh, I assume they meant a Jewish one, but even then, that means you came from a low-class background. And he said, it's a lie. This shook him to the core. And what's really interesting is that you find a lot of discussion in halachic literature by Rabbeinu Yonah and the Ramban, who are the two people affected by this, what exactly is a Pelegesh? And specifically, the famous question in the Middle Ages, is a Pelegesh mutter or usser? Is it only for a king, for a melech, or is it for anybody? And there are a lot of opinions back and forth in this. And there is a famous letter in the Tshuva Rashba, which really means the Tshuva Michos Ramban, the Tshuva from the Ramban, to Rabbeinu Yonah. So remember, they're first cousins, but Ramban is 10 years older. And the Ramban is being asked, what's the bottom line with the Pelegesh? And the Ramban says, it's okay. Now, he's talking about a Jewish Pelegesh. He said, it's okay. You look through the Tanakh. It's in the Tshuva Rashba, Volume 8. Okay? That's if you want to go looking for it. Which I'll tell you again, Tshuva Rashba, Volume 8 is what they call Miuchasas L'Ramban. So it says Tshuva Rashba, really it's the Ramban. Although now the historians will tell you, that's wrong. They really are Tshuva Rashba. But some of them, like the one on the which is in the 280s. You look over there in the 280s. That's, I remember that. It's definitely Ramban writing to Rabbeinu Yonah. And, you know, the Ramban says it's 100% mutter. Okay? Which is strange for us today. But remember, he's a Sephardi. And it's 100% mutter. And this issue about Pelegesh and whether he can have not a second wife, but in addition to the wife of Pelegesh, which sounds totally nuts to us today, for those who know the issue, popped up and down in Jewish history. Down the centuries, even in Ashkenaz, Yaakov Menden and other people like that. And I want to tell you something. In my opinion, I could be wrong, I hope I'm wrong, this is something which will be relevant, give me another two Democratic presidents, because if they permitted gay marriage, then they're going to have polygamy pretty soon in the United States of America. Because if you don't say that a marriage is defined as one man and one woman, then what's the stop? You know, A, B, C, D, E, F, and G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P. You know, you can make any combination you want. Why can't two guys marry one woman in one marriage? Or one guy marry five women, or one woman marry five guys? You know, once you tell them it's just strictly consensual, you can do whatever you want. And all of a sudden, I know it sounds crazy what I'm saying, and I hope what I'm saying is nuts, and that people look back and say Cass was eccentric. But I fear not. I fear that you'll start to see English halachic literature. Oh, what about Pelegesh? What about this? Because the polygamy will become popular in American society, the way that Hollywood and everybody's trying to push the gay marriage to become popular in American society. It's very interesting. So you had this in a different context in the 13th century in Spain, and the Ramban, as I said it was he said it's mutter. Let's put it this way. Honestly, he favored it, although he's pretty positive on it, as I recall in the Tshuva. It's kind of funny. As far as that goes. And again, it's like in the... I remember it's the 8th volume of the Tshuva Rashba. Excuse me. By contrast, this is very interesting to me. By contrast, Rabbeinu Yonah himself is very against it. And in the Shari Tshuva, I just recall this. In the Shari Tshuva, he said, it's in Chelik Shlishi, Shar Shlishi. He's talking about Habala Shivcha, Dom L'chayvim, he says, Bezim Shnei Drachim. He's all against Habala Shivcha. And he means like a shivcha in the house. And he says, Kanoim Pogimbo. And oh my goodness. And besides this, Chil, he's got a long rant on this. Chil el harosh on this, it's Kodesh Hashem, Asher Ohev, Chol Ben Pachla Mokesh, and then Yigalu Shemayim Avono, the God will punish him one way or the other. He's very strongly against it, because this is a hot button item in his time. It's just kind of interesting. The Rabbeinu Yonah, therefore, became known in the super yeshivish world for his lumdas, as they say, you know, in the back of the brachas and such places, and Aliyah Rabbeinu Yonah. However, that's not what's funny is, here's mazel, the luck of the publishing world. That's not what put him on the map. Most people have never heard of Elias Ben Yona. I don't think so. And if they have, they never looked at it. So what is it? He wrote a Musser book. He was into Musser. Now, I want to be clear. This is like Rabbi Aaron Cutler. Musser is important to him, but that's not the Iker. It's interesting. He's not exactly the way we imagine him. But nevertheless, I would say he was a person of Lumdus and Musser. That's who he was. Not philosophy. We saw he was not in today. He was an opponent of Maimonides, but Musser. And he wrote a book, apparently a big book, called Shari Tzedek. And this is supposed to be a grand Musser treatise. In other words, it'd be a typical sort of Ashkenazic style. I'm guessing it'd be something along the lines of a gigantic Archos Chaim or something like that. Maybe I'm wrong, but something like that. What's interesting is most of the book got lost. Only one chapter survived. The chapter survived is Shari Tshuva. This little book put him on the map. And anybody who's ever heard of Ben Yona, I think, knows from the Shari Tshuva. That's what I think. Now, maybe you're one of the unusual people that you're into Sefer Mishle with the Pirush of Ben Yona. He's got one of Mishle. I don't think that's such a popular... I mean, I don't think the average person learns Mishle out there. He does have one of Pirkei Avos, and that one's a little bit more known. But in my opinion, especially anybody who's ever been through any kind of yeshiva, it's the Shari Tshuva. Because they make you have a Musser Seder. There's three famous books from the Musser. It's the Shari Tshuva, Mesil Sharm, and the Orchas Sadigim. Isn't that right? When I was young, like many, I couldn't stand it. You went through the menu with your dad. You used to have a half hour or whatever. I don't remember how long in there, Israel. And, I did my share of Shari Tshuva and this and that and the other. It didn't mean anything. But like everything else, when I hit 30 and I was already married, I had my own time, I did my own way and pace, I rediscovered the book. Same thing with Mesil Sharm. And especially since they published now, already 30, 40 years ago, what I regard as this very, very nice edition. It's very yeshivish in Israel. You've seen it's all Menuchot. It's got Pesach Hashar, it's called. And I remember it's an anonymous author that Rav Shach says on the front, doesn't want to be known, but it's a good pirush. And it is, because it's very minimalistic. And then I said, well, I just discovered an interesting book. And I've gone through the Shari Tshuva a bunch of times since then, from literature point of view, meaning it's interesting Musser Sefer just to see. The best part, and right now, for example, tomorrow night, once a week, now it's the winter, so I have a like you said, a chabur or whatever, in my house with a couple of guys, where we do Shari Tshuva at this part, at this particular time of the year. It's not what we do all year. Now you might say like this, wait a minute, that's for the Chodesh Elul, and you're right about that, there's no question about it. Shari Tshuva is usually associated with pre-Rosh Hashanah, that's true. However, not exactly, I'll tell you what I mean. The Shari Tshuva has like four parts, isn't that right? And the first two parts about how to repent and, like you say, Chodesh El type stuff and how Yago and Anocha and all this kind of business, which are the mechanics of the repentance process. And he's pretty eloquent. He's a very good writer as far as the style goes. It's not something that lends itself easily to translation because he's elegant Hebrew. So once in a while, his Hebrew is a little too elegant unless you have a good pirush at the bottom because he has these turns of phrase which don't work in English. But anyway, forget that. The Shar Shlishi, the third part, he goes through his own personal idiosyncratic interpretation of the Targum Mitzvahs, or a lot of them. That I find fascinating. You understand? That you can do all year long. And so he'll say, what does it mean, Losa Surach Rilavavcha Nechem? What does it mean, Kabbalah Zavich Vesimela? And he doesn't give you a regular one-line business. He's always got a different twist on it. You understand? He's got a different twist on it. And what can I tell you? I found it very, very interesting, and I still do, and this put him on the map. So here's a person who was a big Rosh Hashiva, and his Musser book is what made him famous. It's funny how the world goes. As I say before, he became the Rebbe of a lot of famous people that came after him, all this sort of thing. I forget which exactly was the Rashba Talmud of his, I believe, and people like that. Yeah, I think Rashba was a Talmud of his. He became, as we would call today, one of the big Rosh Hashivas. And his Talmidim also became the big Rosh Hashivas. This is the golden age of the Jews of Aragon. It's the 1200s. That's when you get all the famous names. And it lasted down till 1391, when they were pretty much wiped out. And this is what the Yeshivas live off today. So Rabbeinu is a central character over there. And it seems that after that controversy, when it was the young 20s, he stayed away from fights about the Rambam and that kind of business. Like, majorly. I think, in my opinion, that's the source of the legend, that he went around apologizing for attacking the Rambam, all the rest of it. But as far as I'm aware, I'm not a bucky in this, I don't remember him ever quoting the Rambam. Certainly not in the Shari Tshuva, which is kind of interesting, you know? But on the other hand, he didn't want any fights in the Machlokas because everybody got messed up from it. I think this business with the Pelegish was bothering the family's reputation for years afterwards, and the Ramban strongly condemned those who did that. And so here you have two cousins, and not only are they cousins, but I think their kids married, if I remember correctly. So your two cousins, the Ramban and the Rabbeinu Yonah, both from the same area. Obviously, there was something in the water at that time that you had the growth of some really profound individuals. The Ramban took a turn for mysticism, did he not? For Kabbalah. I don't see this in the Rabbeinu Yonah. He took a turn in Ashkenazic piety. And the Shari Tshuva smells a lot of the Ashkenazic piety, but in the elegant, very elegant Hebrew of the Spanish style. So it's a very nice blend in that regard. And he therefore leaves a very vivid picture in Jewish history. He was, if you're a historian, you want to know what life was like in Spain at that time, you can read the Shari Tshuva. He blasts the Olam constantly. And you can find all the sins Spanish Jews are guilty of, including the one with the Pelegish and all that, in the Shari Tshuva. My goodness, he is no sparer of, you know what I mean, insults. He does all that. But he did it because this is the community in which he lived. And the 1200s was not a bad time in Spanish history particularly, but the Jews always lived on the edge of a sword, and he was part of that era. I think I'll close it down here.
For sponsorship opportunities or to support this podcast, please visit our donate page at www.support.rabbidovidkatz.com.